education is both a process and a stage objectivization. In Jungian psychology, in the 50s, they used to use the term stadia, from the Latin. The Germans love to use those Latin phrases. And if you look at a volume like The Origins and History of Consciousness by Erich Neumann, you'll see that in the development of his book, he shows that consciousness has a history to it. It has an origin, and it has a definite history. And the objective stages of this history are called stadia, stages. If you look at the writings of someone who is extremely accurate mentally, like Soren Kierkegaard, one of his really fine works is called Stages on Life's Way. There have been bestsellers like Gail Sheehy's Passages based upon this kind of indication. Growth always has stages to it. Separate from the stages, which are in many ways based upon a physics outlook on life, a physics outlook which has a mathematical language ability to characterize it, we'll always talk about the objective stages. Different from that, but related to it, is the biological approach that talks about growth in terms of a process. And perhaps in our century, the most famous philosopher to ever talk about this was Henri Bergson, where he talked about creative evolution, and that the basic movement of evolution was duration. Duri, and that duration is an ongoing quality of participation. And about the same time that Bergson was coming out with his books on the way in which time and free will, matter and memory, the two sources of morality, creative evolution, all of these are related to a durational process happening which is characterized by an energy, which he called élan vital, a vital energy, so that the actual movement of development, of growth, is a creative energy that has no stages, and yet, somehow related to this, no stage energy, is the objective energy stages that have been recognized again and again by the most profound minds on this particular planet. This education resolves in a differential way that kind of apparent dualism, so that some of the philosophic implications that are now rising in the history section are able to be appreciated, are coming, as one used to say in the 50s, the threshold of conceptualization is within our reach now. That is to say, we're able for the first time to be able to think about some ideas about what is going on, what is happening. When you began this process, many of you might have come in later, but that's not a function of the wholeness of this pattern. That's the exigencies of your life. But this pattern, this education, began by taking a walk from where you live around your neighborhood and coming back home. That circle, that walk, was the origin of this course. And the actual happening of that walk, the doing of that walk, was not an objective event until you wrote it up. The taking of the walk was completely what we would say, what has always been said of such activities, is natural. It's a part of nature. And we came to understand right away at the very beginning that nature happens. Nature just occurs. And when we are natural, when we are all natural, we simply occur with it. We participate with it. There is a duration that's happening. What it is, we do not know. No one knows. For knowing presupposes a staged, measured process, and also a knower who is able to utilize this measurable stage process. About the time that Andre Bergson was writing about creative evolution, about duration, about élan vital, one of the great French savants, Lucien Lévi-Bruhl, was investigating, in a typical French savant way, but investigating the mind of primitive man. He was still called primitive man at that time. That cavemen were interesting. How did they think? What were they like? What was the mind like in primitive times? And Lévi-Bruhl came up with a phrase that ancient man, archaic man, primitive man, lived in a continuous participation, a mystical participation with nature. And that all of the mythologies of the fall are mythological remembrances of a fall from the mystical participation of nature. That when one is participating with nature, it's like a mystique. And you are simply occurring. It's simply happening. But there's no you there to happen. The you is still dissolved undifferentiably and non-integrally, incidentally, also, in nature. But that nature still has not achieved the level where it is. That nature never is. Nature is always a mystical process of happening, and it never is. And because it never is, the polarity, the is not, likewise does not occur. So isness and is notness, being and nothingness, do not occur in nature at all. What occurs is a mystical participation, which is non-integrable, non-differential. This particular quality occurs before existence, and existence, when it happens, automatically makes a separation. And what makes a separation is an action. What makes existence is a definite action. So that one of the most difficult of all distinctions to make is between an existential positing action and a natural event. And the criteria that allows for the distinction to be made is that existence is able to have an opposite of a nothingness. A nothingness. So that the first stage of growth makes not only the thing, but its shadow. Not only does the thing occur, does the object occur for the first time, but its polarized non-object, the shadow, the missing part of nature, the blotted out shape in the natural flow of this object. So that when one is writing in the French mode of the early 40s, like Jean-Paul Sartre, one is writing of being and nothingness together. They form a pair. And this is an existentialist perspective. And though he is slovenly in many regards, though he is uninformed in innumerable ways, Sartre was extremely active that the object that posits itself becomes the seed, which is the ego, and that the ego always has paired with it a non-self, a shadow exactly in the shape of the ego. Whatever shape the ego takes, the non-self takes that shape and negates the thingness of it. One of the apocryphal stories about Jesus as a young man, one of the very few stories about Jesus as an older boy. Most of it, the stories are before 5 years of age or after maturity. About the only story that survived about the older boy is that he is working with Joseph outside. Nazareth at the time was no village, it wasn't anything. It was just a crossroads that had a craft shop, and Joseph worked at building furniture and things like that. A carpenter. And Jesus was out helping his father. And the mother suddenly appears, frightened, and says, something peculiar has happened in our hut, in our house. And I've tied him to the bed. What have you tied to the bed? I tied an image of you, son, that is completely black, completely shadow, completely nothing. And the apocryphal story is that the boy Jesus, now about 10, maybe 11 years old, runs in and undoes the cord that his mother had tied his shadow to the bed and embraces him and sets him free. I tell you this because it's an indelible way to understand a very peculiar point. Let's fortify it. Let's bring another example. Jung made a great deal in his writings on therapy about the fact that when you start a therapy, the first thing you encounter is your shadow. When you start to deal with your ego, the first thing that it sends up is its non-self, your shadow self. Why? Because the only vehicle that can make some kind of comprehensive move towards dealing with the ego is your own real self, as the Jungians would say. And when your real self begins to deal with the ego experiences, automatically experiences itself as an existentially limited object. And part of its reality as an existentially limited object is its shadow. Mr. Hyde is always Dr. Jekyll. Can't be anybody else. Tries to be someone else, and those kinds of projections onto other people, onto other things, operate as long as one is within the ego. But as soon as you deal with the ego in a real self way, it is dealt with, and the projections all come home, and the shadow self comes out. There's a section of Sartre's Being and Nothingness that was excerpted and enjoyed a rave audience for about a generation. It's called The Transcendence of the Ego. That there's a very peculiar quality that when you bring your deep self into play in an existential challenge to the ego, two things happen almost instantaneously together. The one is that there is a move on your part to grow, to reach a higher stage than the ego, to transcend the ego, to realize the self rather than the ego, the self being on the symbolic level, the ego being on the ritual level. The ego is made up of what you do. The self is made up of what you realize. And as soon as the self begins to challenge the ego to grow beyond itself, to transcend itself, the ego finds this impossible because it cannot tell the difference between a transcendent quality of ego and its own shadow. And so the ego experiences growth to the next stage as a challenge of death. It's going to fall into nothingness. It's going to join its own shadow. It's going to end up nowhere. And the ego is convinced of this, and indeed, the ego should be convinced of this, because this is exactly what happens. The ego negates itself completely. That's how it transcends. Now, you can put a polite language on it and say, well, it's a reconciliation of opposites. A reconciliation of ego and shadow. That makes it. And together, then, one comes up with the self. Those are very polite words for a very, very frightening, perilous process. Because the ego especially has established itself in terms of identification. Its whole basis is upon a pair of convictions called, since Aristotle's time, syllogisms. And the syllogistic pair is that I am this, and at the same time, I am not that. And all the not that's collect together exactly in the same size and shape, a mirror image of all the this is's. So that all the A equals A's in the universe to the ego are all nicely listed with telephone numbers. And all the A is not A prime or A sub 1 or A sub 0 or A superscript N. All the A's that are not A are all collected without phone numbers. So the ego is very happy. It can call up anything that it can identify and is happy of all these friends. We drink together. We party together. and doesn't want to be reminded that it has exactly an equal number of enemies who are perilous, that if you contacted any one of them, they would do you in. You would be killed immediately. You can't even let them know where you are. The non-identities are hitmen who are looking for you. All this is to say that the move from a ritual to a symbolic stage is fraught with peril and needs to have salesmanship. And that's what mythology is all about. In fact, deeper than that, that's what language is all about. Language is the ability for us to mutter to ourselves or to each other to such a degree that we finally, by hook or crook, or cajole, or sometimes just courage, grow. Now, if that were not enough, that's only for openers. Because once we grow, what happens here is that we have transcended an ego but have not made a distinction between a not-self and a transcendent self. The transcendent self, as far as the ego is concerned, is still identified with the shadow. Your higher self is your shadow. And in the mythology, you make some kind of amends that somehow it's a fallen part of the shadow so that the devil is a fallen angel. Oh yeah, the devil originally was in heaven. Originally was the highest angel in heaven. What kind of heaven was it that had Lucifer as the highest angel? Right? That's why the devil's pitchfork is not a tuning fork. La Tenedor de Diablo. Right? Romancing the stone, yeah. The heart of the gem. Is hidden there, but you have to go through that first. Saw a beautiful cartoon one time in Punch magazine, and it had hell, and it had this lake of fire and brimstone, and people were threshing around in it, and on the shore of it was a lifeguard tower with a devil with a pitchfork ready not to save you, but to pitch you back in. And it sat there very happily, looking to see who not to save. This is an odd quality of how the ego in a rebound is all set up with a trigger to identify, or we should say at this stage, misidentify spiritual selves as demonic. Cannot make the distinction. Cannot tell the difference between an angel and a devil. Anything higher than the ego is identified with the non-self. Now this ego quality pervades the tribal level. It pervades the cultural horizon. It pervades mythology. It is stained indelibly in language. Language always carries with it, wherever it is, this particular insidious ambiguity. And the more that one works with language in a precise way, the more one finds that the ability to go into metaphorical qualities of language without the threat is a very high art. Because on tribal level, on cultural level, on ego level, unclear language is like sloppy ritual. It's dangerous. This is why the quality of language that is there in mythology on ritual basis, where the language matches up with ritual, but is talking about spiritual transcendent ways, always pays attention to the necessity to say something directly. There's no flowery efflorescence. There's no sprung rhythm like a Gerard Manley Hopkins in the kind of mythological language that relates to ritual. It's always basic. If you look at transcripts of all the primordial important religious ceremonies in this world, the translations read remarkably alike. Whether you're a Tiwi from Australia or a Hopi from the Arizona area or wherever it is, it doesn't matter. The transcripts always read that the language says something like, I am holy standing here. I am holy when I move. I am holy when I am standing here. We are holy when we move together. It's very simple, basic language, which is descriptive of the action. That profound religious language, which is aiming towards growth to the self level, to the symbolic level, that language always pays attention to making its descriptions very accurate to the ritual actions, so that the care for the selection of ritual actions is like a substrate that guarantees that the language is okay, that there's no jeopardy. Question: how then, if that is true, does the transcendence happen? If we're keeping language simple so that it is annealed to the ritual objective happening so as not to waken the threat of the non-self, how does the transcendent self happen? It happens because the true substrate is not ritual, but nature, and one allows the ritual to dissolve back into nature, and nature makes the transcendence for us. Because nature doesn't have any problem at all realizing itself. Nature has no problem at all with a spiritual self. Mother Nature is at home with the transcendence of the ego. She recognizes deep kinship. These are my children. So that the effectiveness of a ritual is that the spiritual effectiveness, the transcendent effectiveness of a ritual, is that it is able to dissolve itself back into the participation mystique, the mystical participation of nature. You say, well, why doesn't nature then just immediately be spiritual? And the reply is, it is. It's only those who have separated themselves from nature existentially by actions that need to have the stage of dissolving back into nature again. But look here, it's not just that human beings, mankind, that our kind of animal is separate from nature. All existence, whatever exists, is separate from nature. Come again? Every element, every mineral, every molecule, every atom, every subatomic particle that attains existence is separate from nature and needs to be reabsorbed with it in order to be spiritual. So that the conviction that comes after long experience, after hundreds of thousands of years of experience with this, the wisdom tradition recognizes that when man anneals his mythic language with his ritual accuracy and allows that ritual accuracy to be dissolved back into nature, he not only saves himself, but he saves all existence. He saves the animals, he saves the plants. If he knew, he would say he saves the molecules and the cells and the atoms and everything. One reason that subatomic particles have such short half-life is that they don't learn to speak. If you could teach quarks to crack jokes, they would have a problem just going back. I know it sounds stupid and it sounds trivial, but it's a way to mnemonically be alert that once the mind is engendered, once symbols work, the symbols, which are like a transcendence of the ego, are still not out of the woods yet. The deep self that comes in meditation knows that the unresolved ego is still a latent problem in the universe, because that ego is just carried along by the process of nature into transcendence. Didn't really get to transcendence. Not all the time. There are occasions, there are times when egos do transform. And then instead of just transcend, it's called transformation. When an ego really changes its form, how does it change its form? It loses its shadow. It loses its not-is quality. You say, well, this is only for super yogis. The answer is no, not at all. I've several times read out loud the letter that Jung wrote in 1942 to a fellow psychiatrist, and Jung observed that in Orientals, in India, in China, in Asians, there's no such thing as a shadow. When you analyze them, it doesn't come up. There's no shadow. That apparently is not a universal quality of man, but is a happening that occurs because of the way in which, quote, Western personalities have developed, Western history has unfolded. And in fact, Jung notes in other letters about the same time that there is a characteristic difference in therapy between Europeans and Americans. In Europeans, there's always a step-by-step lowering down to the primitive. Always one dreams of going down steps to a basement. Whereas in the New World, the psyche of the Americas, there are no stages going down. One falls instantly to the basement. One is instantly there. So that New World people are somewhere in between Westerners and Easterners, between Europeans and Orientals. They're in a halfway limbo. They have a very peculiar kind of pattern of psyche. It's not one or the other. And that the predilection for this, not one or the other, is not to be reabsorbed into nature so much, but to allow one's activity to be reabsorbed into nature. And so the new world predilection is to let yourself be carried up by your actions and let the actions dissolve into nature and let nature do the transcending that way. This little dog leg. So that the new world definitely recognizes pragmatism, pragmatos, not as a philosophic school so much as the philosophic school recognizes an existential preference. And that this didn't even occur very much until recent times. Because people from Europe, for the first generation or two, do not notice a difference. Their children don't notice a difference, grandchildren don't, but it's only after a while. So one asks, what about Asians who come to the New World? The same thing happens in the other way. They also end up half and half. They end up with sort of semi-shadow. And the difference is not really refined philosophical or very, very subtle psychological. It's there. If you look at a Chinese who's been raised in Hong Kong, they're very different from Chinese on the mainland. They have a little bit of egotistical arrogance that you do not find. You find a lot of willfulness on mainland Chinese. Don't worry about it. Plenty willful, but it's not egotistical arrogance. Whereas Chinese, after several generations, become just like Europeans after several generations. They become new worldized, Americanized, and they come halfway. They don't really have shadows which one could really deal with. Don't really have Mr. Hyde's, but they have like a halfway version of it. So on certain days you can say, well, it's not too bad, and on other days you can say it's really bad. So there's a kind of ambivalence in the American psyche about transcendence and about dealing with evil. A very interesting problem. Incidentally, Asians themselves notice the difference. The Japanese more than any others because they're very ritually oriented, very egotistically bound up in the cultural traits, and that's why they have even names for first generation removed from Japan, second generation, the sensei, the nisei, so forth. And after three generations of remove, they don't even refer to them as Japanese anymore. It doesn't matter that their DNA is Japanese, that they look Japanese, but they are not Japanese. It's like the body snatchers have replaced them. So that the identifying quality is not racial, it's not even DNA, but it is ego. Ego that fits into a cultural language which is annealed to a ritual comportment. And the reason for that identification and its accuracy and its necessity is that only when all of that as a package, as an ensemble, is tied together, can it dissolve back into nature and some kind of transcendence be possible as a gift of the universe, as a gift of life. Otherwise, there would be no way to develop an interior realm. No way at all. You would be forbidden. You would forbid yourself. But as we've seen, one of the odd things that happens, as soon as an interior world is developed, as soon as the self, as soon as the symbolic level is there, it all by itself not only integrates but rebounds. And when it rebounds, it creates what we call vision. What in the most ancient times was called magic. What psychologically one could call consciousness. That the rebound of an interior world is that there is a conscious reverberation that now happens and fills time-space. That the dimension of consciousness now permeates by vibrational resonance time-space. Anyone who develops an interior realm affects the time-space around them by vibrations from their consciousness. Consciousness, by the way, is a measurable vibration. You know now that the USAF, United States Air Force, USAF runs test planes by brainwaves from pilots. Yeah. A palpable reality, as palpable as ritual events. But consciousness is not palpable on vision level, not palpable on magic level, because vision, or magic, however you wish to call it, consciousness, however you wish to call it, is not a stage. It's a process, and it's very similar to the way in which nature is a process. And once consciousness happens, it changes nature by adding another dimension to it, just like adding to time-space. One now speaks of time-space consciousness. This nature now is what is needing to be participated with. You can no longer participate with nature, time-space. You have to participate with modified, transformed nature, time-space consciousness. And right away, growth is no longer possible if you use ritual as your beginning. Because ritual is only effective in a growth way if it can dissolve itself and its whole ensemble and entourage of myth and symbol back into nature. But now that nature is transformed, using the Elizabethan quality here of language, a transformed man is not going to be able to stay in the same universe that he was. And so exactly what the ego feared happens to the self. The self falls out of nature, and if the self is not educated to know this, it mistakenly goes back and checks with last pilot that was flying the flight, the ego, and the ego says, I told you so. You better hand over the keys to me. I'll drive. This condition is called, even natives on the lowest tribe primitive level call this loss of soul. Whatever language they use, or even if they don't use a language, they mean loss of soul, and someone like that becomes totally dejected. Now, you can temporize that by pills and by events, by going to concerts, by athletics, by fancy clothes, good cars, fine food. The reality is that the soul is lost, and the self, the mind, is demoralized. And the ego is now back in control, and vengeance loves nothing better than to start keeping score. It loves to tally things up and to find blame. Well, who's to blame for this? The phrase, I think, when I was growing up is, all right, who's the wise guy? Notice how in the phrase, who's the wise guy, the blame goes to someone who was supposed to know better or said they knew better. when this creates perfect conditions, nice little culture for the bacteria of martyrdom prejudice to grow. And they come looking for you. Dostoevsky called his novel about this The Idiot. Yeah. Because that's what happens. Frazier wrote a whole book in the Golden Bough, it's called The Scapegoat. That's how it is. And it doesn't matter who's who. The first scapegoat in the Bible is Isaac, his own father. Says, well, somebody's got to pay for this. My son will pay for this. Moses didn't put in the reply of the Lord quite accurately. He said, you stupid son of a bitch, you would kill your own son? When it's you, it's not Isaac at all. That was left out. What it does say is that instead of Isaac, he's told, look, whose horns are caught in this bush, this goat, and sacrifice this horn. This horned beast whose horns are caught in the bramble of this bush. The bush, when it burns, is a sign of the transcendent self. And the goat with the horns is a sign of the devil. When you can learn to distinguish the devil, the non-self, from the spirit, then the sacrifice that was really necessary is made. You don't have to kill people, especially your son. Sorry. Let's take a break. All of this is to set the stage and prepare us for some very powerful ideas. Here they are. The first indication is a quotation from Teresa, from her great classic, The Way of Perfection. She writes, this is chapter 30, paragraph 4, among the many other joys of the kingdom of heaven, the principle appears to me to consist in a disregard of all earthly things, and a peace and beatitude which rejoice and delight in the bliss of one's companions. The soul dwells in perfect peace and feels supreme satisfaction at seeing that all those around it honor and praise God and bless His name, and at knowing that they never offend Him. In heaven, everyone loves Him. The soul cares for nothing but loving Him. It cannot cease to do so because it knows Him as He is. If only we knew Him, we should love Him in the same way in this world, and although not so constantly and so perfectly as in heaven, yet very differently from what we do now. The very famous section of St. Teresa. Notice here that when consciousness occurs in vision, nature is consumed in the transformation. Consciousness takes nature and transforms it and adds itself to it so that it isn't that nature is no longer there, but that nature is operating now in a transformed mode. So that when we say that vision displaces nature, it's not that a thing comes and butts some other thing out. Nature is not a thing to butt out. Vision is not a thing to butt out, but you have two processes, and the one process absorbs the other and adds to it. And one of the qualities that's added to it is the traditional word for it is love. Vision adds love to nature. That the vibratory quality of consciousness is love. Now, consciousness per se is just simply zero-based actuality. There's no doubt about that. And because it's zero-based actuality to perfection, it doesn't even occur. It's not only not a thing, but it's also not even an occurrence. But the very growth, that growth motion going to a higher stage, it has a quality, and that quality is love. And one asks, what is the higher stage from mind? The higher stage is person. Why is person a higher stage than mind? Because person is a manifestation out of a larger reality, out of a nature which has now conscious love in it. And if one were simply very pure in the transcendence, in the growth, this is what would occur, but most frequently it doesn't occur. Why? Because there's still the leftover residual of the ego and its inability to make a distinction between shadow and higher self, between shadow and spirit. The ego cannot tell the difference between devils or angels. And because the ego is always objective in terms of power and position, it is always sold on identifying whoever has the power and the position as being the real, being the better of the two, being the real. And what doesn't have power, what doesn't have position, is the inferior. So it makes the distinction between devils and angels on basis that angels will always have more power and position, and the devils are the ones that don't have it. Notice here that humility doesn't rate very high on ego's assessment of what is in charge. So that somebody who's really worked at this particular bind, this particular problem, someone like, say, St. Francis of Assisi, knows that the only hope for an accurate balance here is to take a vow of poverty. Because power and position very often are conflated into wealth. Money. Now this whole situation that Teresa shows us here is related to the way in which Tacitus begins his histories, and we'll get to that in just half a minute. But let's review again. Teresa says, among the many other joys of the kingdom of heaven, the principle appears to me, that is to say, she's talking from a personal standpoint, from the objective personal standpoint, from the art of the person. The principle seems to me to be a disregard of earthly things. Why is this so? Because just as vision transforms nature, art transforms ritual. Real art transforms, really, real ritual. Just as vision adds consciousness to nature, transforming it, art adds consciousness to ritual, transforming it. So that art is markedly different from ritual. How marked? It's as different from ritual as visions are from nature. And the difference is practical in the sense that art and vision are differential energies. They expand out into more and more variants, greater and greater freedom. Whereas nature and ritual always integrate. They always tend to come to some real focus. Existence is the real purpose of integrating nature. Why does nature integrate? So that existence is real. No doubt. Why is a variety of persons real? Not only a true principle, but real. Why should we say that the more variety of persons there are, the better it is for everyone? Because that's the differential mode reality of the art of the person displacing ritual. It's very, very interesting once one begins to see in this way. So that earthly things, and it's not just earthly things like having a lot of this or a lot of that, it's like on a primordial level, all existence, all extant things become disregardable, not in devaluing them, but in transforming one's taste, one's preference for personable qualities. Now, even wealth. The gold, which ritually one would value in certain ways, now is valued for what good it can do. But still, even on this level, the unresolved ego is like a radioactive infection that's still lurking, temporarily out of play because growth is happening. But should there be any kind of halt to growth, any kind of impedance, the dynamic is always such that you will either grow or regress, one or the other. You either keep growing or you regress. There's no way not to be different from this. So impedance or resistance to growth at this stage invokes a regression, and as soon as the regressive quality comes into play, the ego begins to wake up again from its somnambulance, unless it's been really transformed. And one of the indications is that people begin to have a preference for ritual over art. That laws and rules take a precedence over people. These are bad people, and they're going to have to learn to be like us. So that on level of civilization, this is the beginnings of tyranny. And this kind of tyranny has a particular ideology involved in it. And the ideology is a return back to a no-nonsense, existential-based way of getting things straight. And what progressively gets left out are people who are different from some kind of measurable norm which is deemed the way. And were it just this simple, it would be simple. People would have long ago woke up to this and dealt with this. But it's not simple because it always takes an errant kind of a form. It always takes the form that rule of law is what we're really after. Law and order. And in a philosophically objective way, even the surrogate in between of the rule of law would be all right were it applied conscientiously, but it is not. It is always applied with a skew. Always. And the skew is what Tacitus first points out in the histories. First page he points it out. Here's what he says. He's saying this of the experience of Rome, because he's fresh on the scene. This is the first time that Rome has really consolidated the empire, worldwide, world-class power. And the event that did that, that consolidated, was the elimination of all competitors to Octavian, who became Augustus Caesar, and the last battle was fought at Actium in 31 BC. Mark Antony was militarily defeated, and he was burnt out. He was completely psychologically decimated in that he began to regress, and what came out of this was a psychological decompression, a loss of soul, so that instead of the Mark Antony who had been Julius Caesar's right-hand man and a contender for the Roman Empire, much more likely than weakly Octavian. Octavian was not a very strong physical specimen. Mark Antony was a hell of a man. He took Cleopatra, he had the army, he had everything. But once he was beaten at Actium, he had a loss of soul. And finally, less than a year later, just a few months later, he died riding out on a horse single-handedly with his sword to the miles and miles of Roman legions surrounding Alexandria, and he asked them, somebody come and kill me and give me a soldier's death. Give me a Roman soldier's death. No longer going to be a mystical emperor with Cleopatra of the universe, but he just wanted to be a Roman soldier. Let me die like a Roman soldier. And Octavian, understanding such things, initially refused to let anyone go out because he didn't want to touch the archetypal energy, because he knew that Antony was infected. Tacitus writes, right at the beginning of the histories, first page, when the Battle of Actium had been fought and the interests of peace demanded the concentration of power in the hands of one man, the great line of classical historians came to an end. Truth, too, suffered in more ways than that one, to an understandable ignorance of policy, which now lay outside public control. Making policy was no longer in public control, it was in control of one man. In due course was added a passion for flattery, or a hatred of autocrats. Two things. A passion for flattery, a hatred of autocrats. Lapping it up or bitching about it. Those two. Thus, Tacitus is very sharp. Thus, because lapping it up and bitching it always come together, thus neither school, neither those who were lapping it up nor those who were bitching about it, neither school bothered about posterity, about writing histories, about understanding. One was bitterly alienated and the other deeply committed. Committed and alienated. But whereas the reader can easily discount the bias of self-serving historians, those who lap it up, we can tell right away, they're brown-nosy, lapping it up. We can see that right away. detraction and spite find a ready audience. Adulation bears the ugly taint of subservience, but malice gives the false impression of being independent. You bet. It's worth the price of the whole year. The ego always skews back with malice as a viewpoint, and because you have a regression, because there's regressive energy coming back and everything is falling back, loss of soul, the whole thing, there's fantastic security in malice. It's the root of violence, folks. This is why someone, a great karma yogi like Gandhi, talked about ahimsa, non-violence. He didn't talk about peace as an object. He talked about non-violence because that's the only thing. The ego is already skewed towards malice. It cannot identify anything that we would call peace, real peace. It identifies peace with its interests. It mishears all the time. So you have to talk about shadow type stuff, non-violence, negatives. That's the way that you talk about it. Because it's the only language that has any chance at all of making its way, and very little chance at that. But added to this, Tacitus's time is an archetypal change of aeon, change of era. Not just a change from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire. 750 years, Rome was a republic. And the empire was just maybe 50 years old, 100 years old at the time that Tacitus was writing it, 50 years old at the time he's writing about it. But he says, a little later on, a few pages later on, a quotation taken out. It may be that mysterious prophecies were already circulating and that portents and oracles promised Vespasian and his sons the purple robe, the emperorship. But it was only after the rise of the Flavians that we Romans believed in such stories. In a time of not only individual regression, there's also at the end of a corrupt age, the age of iron, is the last stage of the corruption of the whole civilization on top of it. So you not only have individuals struggling with this, but you have the entire context equally struggling with the same issue. And so one has an eerie situation where the biases of the malice-addicted ego find confirmation everywhere in the world at large. All the surveys that it would take would show that it was right to hate these bastards and put them in their place, which is get rid of them. All right, we've had enough of you. That kind of talk, that kind of action, it's a universal process. It always happens this way, but in these kinds of situations, it happens in a peculiar, poignant way, very, very, very rapidly, very deep. And he says on the same page, another quotation taken out, Egypt had been governed since Augustus's day, that is, since 30 BC, Egypt had been governed by Roman equestrians serving as successors to the Ptolemies. And here's the rub in the whole thing. Here's the trigger. Here's the poison on the dagger. Not only do they have a dagger, and they have a whole societal condition that confirms you have every right, you should have a dagger. But it should have poison on it, too. What's the poison? The poison is that Roman knights, equestrian rank means that you were a knight. It means that you were of the propertied, moneyed class of noble families. The knight always had the right to raise armed militias to support him physically in the field. The king doesn't raise an army. The king convinces the knights to raise their contingents and pool those, and that's what the army is. The only military power outside of that is setting up the state as a super individual and having the legions sequestered by the state so that the state is like a super knight and the legions are its levy of men. So in the Roman Empire, you have the state becoming a super individual, and you have increasingly that the equestrian class of Romans, instead of being on the field leading their men, they did managerial positions and let atrophy the raising of republican arms and let the state raise its mercenary legions. And usually they weren't even Romans or Italians. They're mercenaries, paid professionals. But you have the psychology of wealthy Romans in an atrophying situation, taking the place of divine king representatives. Because the rulers of kingdoms were always kings, and there was divine kings. The Pharaoh of Egypt was a divine representation. So you have an egotistical Roman psyche that's in regression, being confirmed by situations, and the poison on it is they were convinced that they were then participating with a divine activity. And so you have Romans, for the first time, individuals, atrophied managerial individuals who have no real power, because the military power is with the legions, with the state, imagining themselves unable to differentiate themselves from candidates for being divine kings. And that's exactly what happened to Mark Antony. It's exactly what happened to Julius Caesar. The divinizing of Julius Caesar by Augustus Caesar was the way in which he cinched the Roman Empire. Instead of divinizing himself, saying, I'm divine, he said, my predecessor, the origin of the Caesar line, my uncle, he is divine. And I am his heir. I'm his heir. I inherit that power. I was chosen by him. And indeed he was. Julius Caesar, very, 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 very brilliant man. Light years beyond Mark Antony. Julius Caesar really symbiotic. And Julius Caesar saw that the only working power combination is to unify the head of the religion with the head of the state in one person. And Julius Caesar is the first man to become Pontifex Maximus. He became pope before there were even popes. It became a famous issue in the Middle Ages. The war of power between popes and kings. That's what Henry VIII was all about. Julius Caesar, way back in the first century BC, saw that the way that you cement it is that you make the head of the religion and the head of the state the one person, and then you allow your person to be perceived to be absorbed by the state so that you are the state. The famous Hitler tactic. I speak for the German people because I am the state. I am the conscious state of the German people. And a population of people who are in regression, doesn't matter how sophisticated they were, they are now in regression, they are absorbed by that without their even having the ability to give permission or not. This is a famous issue in Germany. The person who relentlessly looked at this problem was Karl Jaspers. A little book, The Question of German Guilt. Extremely profound. And after that, he wrote a great book on the nature of history. That horrible as it is, one has to look at the situation and understand that it is not primitive people who become ideological fodder for world-class tyrannies. It is very psychologically sophisticated people who regress tremendously and become all the way back to depending on rituals to carry the existential weight of reality rather than the human person carrying the weight of reality. And instead of the variety of individuals being like a bouquet of the freedom of the universe, which it really is, the less kinds of people there are, the better, the easier to control. The Nazis used some word, I always purposely forget it, like Gelichtigkeit or something. It means mushing it all together so it's one thing, unity. When all of the armed men goose-stepped together so that you could see across the nation that they're all moving together, then the gears of power are in place. It's that kind of thing. Whereas the actuality of the universe is that it would be strange to have any two people so similar that they would be walking together unless they chose to. So that the Ptolemies, who were a royal dynasty, inheritors of the power of a divine king, Alexander the Great, replaced by Roman knights, rich, mounted, state-backed, independent egos, inherited divine kingship, and their state inherited likewise the title and position of divine kingdom, so that the Roman Empire and later the Roman Church became the divine kingdom. And whoever headed it was able to dole out the equestrian quality of being able to raise your fighting forces or your money, whatever it is. Usually it's money. Tacitus then says that all of this is cinched, all of this is confirmed by the ego's preference for portents and oracles. That's how he says. He says portents and oracles. For that you can read miracles and saints. That's how it's cinched together. Formalized saints are not the saints. The saints themselves, like Saint Teresa, are very, very fine, visionary persons. No doubt, Teresa of Avila is a visionary person and world-class quality. But Saint Teresa is a whole different phenomenon. She is a part of a state empire-signed miracle and saint, oracle and prophecy, portent syndrome, and has her place. It's totally different, completely different. So that Tacitus comes to say, finally, Italy itself fell victim to disasters which were quite unprecedented or had not occurred for many centuries. Whole towns were burnt down. Whole cities were buried, like Pompeii, buried by Vesuvius in 70 AD, the same year, almost the same season that Jerusalem was destroyed by Titus, Vespasian's younger son. Fires destroyed venerable temples. Things holy were desecrated, adultery in high places, swarming with exiles, blood everywhere, and people, men, helping themselves to priesthoods and councilships. So that it becomes like a syndrome. All of these elements, once they're in place, lock. They're all like teeth that make up a single gear. And once the gear is there, the gear locks into place. And if you don't develop cogs, you don't go anywhere. Because that gear is the only reality that's happening. There's a famous scene in Charlie Chaplin's The Great Modern Times, I think it is, where he's in the factory with the big wrench and he gets caught in the gears. And because he has no gears on himself, he doesn't fit in, he's just spit out through the machine. A beautiful, succinct understanding of this. Chaplin's really excellent. And the way that you're spit out is through non-acknowledgement. Remember Stravinsky? The modern sin is non-acknowledgement. Say what you want. We're not going to respond. We're not going to let anybody know. You're not going to have any way to let anybody know. Nobody will care. Talk all you want. There won't be anybody there. It'll be a serenade to an empty room. And if you're the least bit infected by loss of soul, this preys on you and the infection takes over right away and you're radioactive in less than an hour. If you don't know what's real and don't have the courage to live what's real, this is what happens. Then you get smart and you get busy making the gears so that you can get something going. Hey, how do you like my new gears? This kind of quality, Tacitus is impeccable at bringing into play. So that when one reads, here's a study of Tacitus, Religion and Philosophy and the Histories of Tacitus, published by the American Academy in Rome, Papers and Monographs, 22, 1968. If one now attempts to understand the nature of the Augustine Restoration, what was the Augustine Restoration? Augustus said, he didn't say, I'm building a Roman Empire. He said, I'm restoring the dignity of the Roman people. I'm restoring things back so that the new situation, he didn't call it an empire, he called it the Principate, from which we get the term prince. You're used to fairy tales where the prince is Prince Charming. In court life, princes are never nice. There are always a lot of them. They're always the most conniving people because they all want to be king and they're all just one murder from being king. And they want to make sure that people are behind them and not going to knife them because they're ready to knife anyone. So they're always testing people by plots. In real noble court life, when you have several thousand years experience with it, princes are the worst. You don't want to hear about them. The Augustine Restoration was that in this situation, there's only one prince, me. That was the nature of the Roman Empire. They backed into being emperors. He didn't say, I am emperor. He just said, there's only one prince, and it's me. So if you want to curry favor, there's only one person to curry favor with. And not because I'm emperor, but because I'm simply first citizen. Yeah, that's the phrase was first citizen. You can have any opinion you want, but in voting, you have to ask me first, and then we'll see who agrees with me. Yeah. That's how it works. That's why Machiavelli's book in the Renaissance, where we're going to get to, is called The Prince. It's one of the most perfect profiles of power ever done. Because the prince has the way of perfection in terms of conniving. He understands things as they really are. They're regressive, they're egotistical, and everyone's looking to get the right gears, and what you do is you sell files so that they can file themselves to fit. That's a big business. There are a lot of guys out there with books and TV appearances and the whole thing selling nice files. You can get the right gears. You can have perfect health. You can have all. If one now attempts to understand the nature of the Augustine Restoration, it seems to me that the label of falsity at least may be discarded. It wasn't a scam. It wasn't false. Augustus was very serious about this. Religion had been thrown into confusion along with other phases of Roman life in the darkness of the first century. But from our into the darkness, what darkness? The shadow. Not only the shadow of individuals, the shadow of the whole aeon. The shadow of the entire people, everyone. But from our preceding efforts to determine its strength down to this point in time, it does not appear that it died along with the Republic. Religion didn't die. It was still there. The very success and scope of the Augustan revival militate against such a conclusion. The gods appear in their temples in a heightened Greco-Roman form, it is true, but a number of old usages are present to remind one of the strength of tradition and perhaps a traditional state of mind in conceiving the gods. What would be a traditional way of conceiving the gods? That they show themselves by portents and oracles. You can prove your divinity by miracles. If you can't levitate this cup of water, what kind of a world teacher are you? You can't sharpen this pencil by force of your mind? No miracles, no followers, no gears. So oracles, oracular qualities, prophecy, divination, all of this came under state control, under penalty of death. Not only every book of prophecies, every page of every book, every fragment of every page of every book of prophetic oracular literature in the world that was reachable was collected and sent to Rome under penalty of death. If you held back anything, you were killed. It's a serious business. And it was collected and codified and put into one master computer. Excuse me. I didn't mean that. So that there was one master reference, which everybody knew were the specs on gears. And because in order to contest this, you would have had to be an incredibly learned and courageous spiritual giant genius, almost everybody gave up. You can appreciate how tough Jesus was. He's a toughie. Unbelievably scruffy in taking it on. Think of the... think of some of the incidents, and I'm actually surprised at the virulence. With the return of political stability, this sentiment could be more coherently expressed. That is, they got the mythology straight, they got the rituals organized, so that its existence is revealed by the way the Romans of the Augustan era accounted to themselves for the hideous spectacle of civil war through which they had passed. If we're so powerful and we're so right, why all of this? Why all of this tussle? Cicero had already quoted the fundamental tenet of the state. And then they give a quote here in Latin from De Harpuscium Responses. It means the responses of the soothsayers. There was an issue in Rome where there was a tremendous noise heard in a part of the city, and soothsayers were brought in. This is 56 BC. And the state, with its state soothsayers, pointed a finger at exactly one person and one condition. And Cicero responded to this, and he writes, And indeed, who is so witless that when he gazes up into heaven, he fails to see that gods exist and imagines that chance is responsible for the creations of an intelligence so transcendent that scarce can the highest artistry do justice to the immutable dispositions of the universe? Or who, once convinced that divinity does exist, can fail at the same time to be convinced that it is by this power that great empire has been created and extended and sustained? And he goes on to say that it's this way that political structures are expressed by individuals who can confirm the spirit in themselves and share that spirit with others, so that the forms of men express that shared confirmation on the basis of their persons. Cicero was the last of the great republicans in Rome. In fact, when they wanted to make sure that everyone understood that this kind of man was no longer viable, when they murdered Cicero, they cut his hands off and they nailed his decapitated hands to the podium in the Senate of Rome to show everyone that it was out of these kinds of hands forever. And one of the first gears that you sharpened under the empire was you learned not to speak up. You never, under any circumstances, speak up. First rule. Second rule, you learn to be very clever in listening. You listen to who's able to speak up, and you try to follow what they're saying and get it exact, because that's what's happening. Does it sound familiar? It's never different. Every change of aeon for 100,000 years has been the same way. Same way. That's why the wisdom tradition is so reliable. Because not only are the diseases the same, but the cure is the same, too. Please, for next week, if you haven't already done so, try to read the section on Flavian caution in Tacitus's history. It's not very long. In fact, it's page 81 to 87. 6 pages. If you read 1 page a day, if you read before you went to work and after you came to work, half a page at each meal, if you will take a half a page with each meal and just read those, and then couple with that in St. Teresa, the section on continuous distress and sudden rapture and a true sense of values, that would be the latter part of chapter 20. Let's say chapter 20, but if you can't get to the whole chapter 20, at least the second half of chapter 20. Chapter 20 is 10 pages. So 10 pages, page 136 to 146 in Teresa. I mean, it sounds ostensibly like a school lesson, right? It's not. It's a chance for you to experience personally, because the only viable protagonist in the historical process is the person. And if your person is not being viable, then your shadow certainly is being viable and is finding ways to get back into being what? Not being in charge, no, into being not in charge. And the only way for it to be not in charge is for the ego to be brought back. It's the shadow that wakes up the ego. Like distraught bad kid who wakes up a bad parent and says, all this is going on, do something. And even if bad parent punishes bad child, bad child is very happy because bad parent did something. It's on that level of stupidity that regression happens. That's it. Duffy's Tavern.